right. Hi, everybody. So I'm Carolyn Elliott.
And I am Layla Bernard.
And we are here today with our very special coaching mentors, teachers, spiritual illuminators, Robert D. McDonald and Luzette Celeste McDonald. They're both doctors, they're both ministers and geniuses. And we have been so gifted, and we're also with a number of other participants who've been here with us.
For a week in Los Angeles at the Healing the Wounded Heart training, part one.
Yes, and Healing the Wounded Heart is this incredible training that teaches you how to help people resolve painful memories.
By doing mind surgery.
But yes, really, it's very quite literal magic. And Layla and I want to have a follow-up podcast soon after this one where we really go into talking about how what Robert and Luzette do connects with magical traditions.
Yes, because Robert and Luzette work through what is called the Talos Institute or the Talos Healing Center. The Talos Healing Center. And we, of course, are, you know, heretical Thelemites. And there turns out that there is a deep connection between Thelema and Talos.
There's a direct etymological connection.
At the level of the word, there is a connection between those things, which we will expound upon in a future podcast. So
Tune into that, and also just to the whole history of magic in the West, because lots to say about it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's been turning me on so much this past week is thinking about there's the Hermetic teaching that all is mind. We everything that we experience is mind.
Popularized in the
Kabbalion. Mm-hmm. And also, my dad turned me on to this amazing philosopher, Bernardo Kastrup, who explains this very well, but also sadly is kind of stuck in materialist, atheistic thought that doesn't really know what to do with this profound information. That's one of the amazing healings that Robert and Luzette bring, is to tie the mind to the spirit and soul. All is mind, and everything that we experience is, believe it or not, just in your head. And we like to quote Lon Milo Duquette, who says, when people ask, but isn't all this magic stuff just, in your head? And the answer is, yes, but your head is just, a way lot bigger than you think it is. So these techniques that Robert and Luzette so generously teach and excellently teach and clearly teach, are technologies for changing the mind so that your emotional experience is altered and for the way, way better.
Yes. And I just wanted to mention, I forgot to say it, my wonderful husband, David, is also here with us. He's also taken Healing the Wounded Heart for the second time.
Yes. Hello, everyone. It was completely life-changing the first time. And again, it is, life-changing experience that just, there's so much in it. I had to go through it a second time and continue mining the depths that are so generously taught here.
Yeah, so we figured that what we would do right now would be, because we've interviewed Robert and Luzette on the podcast before, so maybe, some of you have heard that, but we wanted to have them just state a little bit about the kind of work that they've been doing for years successfully all around the world, so you have a sense of the wow factor.
We've heard dozens of stories over the past week of just the literal miracles of people walking in terrible, traumatized, or just dysfunctional, sadness, stuck states, receiving these processes, walking through them, and then being resolved.
And not only have we heard the stories, but we've literally experienced it ourselves, so we know it's not bullshit. It's really true.
Correct. It is. And watched people go through, profound experience of healing that moved me to tears several times this weekend.
Yes. So my thought was to have them explain a little bit of that overview, and then for them to tell us about their life stories, because I'm very interested in people to getting to know Robert and Luzette better, because it's not like they do this work based on pure book learning and theory and whatever. It's like they've both had really painful experiences in life that they learned how to resolve and truly heal and recover from, so that they're they're just delightful people to be around. Their
truly
vibrations
delightful.
Are not carrying any resentment or, misery. Their vibrations are carrying like such pure
a beacon of what is possible for a human
I
being.
I love you too.
Well, it's so stunning and it's so rare. And you know, David and I were telling Robert and Luzette how you know, we feel like we've been looking for genuine elders our whole life, and we know a lot of older people, and they've all gravely let us down by not being any more mature than we are. Sometimes very less. And so it's been just so amazing, because I feel like, you know, I don't want to put Robert and Luzette on pedestals, because they're human beings, but they're like real human beings, like
real humans, real boy and girl.
Such a rare thing in our culture to have people who have developed true wisdom, true skill. So like not just love and compassion, but the extreme skillfulness to apply that compassion and like enact it into resolving unnecessary human suffering. Right. So I guess that's a good enough.
Without any further
ado, here's Robert and Luzette in their own words.
Hello,
we're so happy to be here and excited to even know about ourselves better.
Yeah, who are we, these people you're talking about? Yeah, well, Luzette, why don't you go ahead and answer these questions.
Well, the question is, who am I? Well, I'm happy and a whole complete person. And you know, truly, as far as a little bit of a background about me, how do I start at the beginning of my birth?
Yeah. Well, who are you today?
My mother was 46. That would seem like a miracle when she had me, right? Okay. To begin with. So that was pretty cool, because you know, I came down because I knew I was supposed to be here. And everything that I've learned, I read a lot of books, and I'd always be going, well, how do you make those changes? And I did in-depth spiritual classes and work, and became a minister and ordained and doctorate of divinity, and loved all the spiritual awareness I have. And then many times I think, well, I need more skills. And I was thinking of going back to get my degree in psychology, and I had a dream that there was a main freeway, and I was on the side of it. I wasn't on the main road, and that wasn't my direction and where I was to go in all my learning. My family, we had doctors and lawyers and everything, but mine was a different kind of learning, life learning. I was widowed when I was 28. That was major. And if totally healed from it spiritually, and then when I met Robert many times, because <Yeah. laughs> I prayed for my new soulmate after my first one died, you know, and Robert shows up 2 years later, but I wasn't ready, and so I felt like he'd really find out that there was something wrong with me. Oh. And so I put out my cardboard self, and I was delightful, because I could be that way, you know. I knew how to act, what to say and do. And then that was it. Then we parted ways for many years.
I wasn't ready either.
And he wasn't ready either. And so then we saw each other, what was that, 8 years later, and I had remarried, and I couldn't pay attention to him at all when he gave me his song CD that he'd made. And what do I want this for? I heard him sing it.
It was all love songs.
I heard him sing it.
Of course it was.
Wonderful. Yeah. He gave me a cassette, actually. It was a cassette time.
Yeah, it's very old. Very old.
And I wouldn't listen to it. I gave it to someone else. Like, I'm married. I'm not going to listen to him sing, right?
True.
And then he did a workshop. At that time, he was teaching NLP, and I went to it, and I thought, what's this? I do better with my prayer treatment, you know, which I was trained in. So I understand when people think about our work, or is this real or what? Because I felt that way. And so then what was it? Two years later, I saw you again. And then it was in 1998, he shows up. Now I'm a minister teaching. And I thought he was someone I'd seen a year ago, because his energy was great. And I thought, well, he's a singer. I got to have him come sing again. Well, I found out he had just participated in helping one of his best friends make a transition into the new life. And so his energy, it was very unique, you know, because he stood out from everyone. It was like a real sad light. It was great. And then when he came and he said, well, hi, I'm Robert McDonald. I remembered everything. It was like a curtain open, and I knew I was to be with him. And dreamt about him every night for 2 years. So that was a little bit, of our romance.
I know, I love this story.
That was great. And yet what I had prayed for was the most effective change work in the world. I knew it had to be somewhere because I was stuck. And so on the phone 2 days later, he took me through a process that you all learned and will be practicing that's called conflict integration. And he talked to me. I didn't know what, I just listened. I was honest. I told the truth. And by the time we got done talking, which it only took, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes, I absolutely felt transformed because I had a new gift of courage. And so I started telling the truth to people. I'd even say, like, will you pick up that cup over there? Where before I would take care of everything at our church because I was codependent. You know, I was always, I'll take care of you.
And you thought that's what it meant to be loving.
That's right.
Yeah.
Give. You're such a loving being. Yeah. I didn't want to be loved. Just let me love you.
Yeah.
And so anyway, that began my in-depth journey with Robert, and I wanted to learn everything he knew. And that's been 25 years.
Yeah.
So I know a lot. So I'm lucky, and I'm so happy to be with him. And this class we just put on was phenomenal. But all things... Absolutely. I always stand in the light of knowing everything's possible and all things can be changed.
Well, Lizette, I would just love
unnecessary suffering. Yeah.
This is my selfish desire, is to hear more about your journey of like coming to the like profound life of spiritual devotion that you've had. Because I've heard Dr. Robert speak about how he's learned so much from you about the world of spirit.
Yeah.
And so I just really see you as a great teacher in that regard. And I'd love to hear about, you know, how you came to be a minister and where that impulse came from you even as a child or.
Sure.
I'd love to hear
about
that.
Well, raised very Catholic. I was always devout and dedicated. I would go into church in second grade and pray for people. And then they were saying like Mary was bleeding in place. So I'd go in to look to see the statues. I mean, really at a young age, because I thought that was the thing to do. And then I realized I was way too sexual and liked to be sexy when I, you know, took my glasses off and dyed my hair blonde in eighth grade, right?
Oh,
met the Italian, right?
Oh.
So Italian stallion. But my dedication was always there. I went to the Catholic Church every single week. And then after Carl's suicide, that's what took me really deep.
That was your first husband.
Yeah, my first husband. I was on the path to be a practitioner because I loved the teaching of Science of Mind, which was by Ernest Holmes. I loved it. So I would go to, this is dedication, I would go to the Catholic Church and Science of Mind Church back to back every Sunday. And I did that for 7 years and took my girls. I had two girls that I raised as a single mom. So my dedication was there. And then it became to heal. And then I wanted to be a minister to help everybody, you know, so they could be okay. Because after having that shock of a suicide, you know, from, you know, like we were Romeo and Juliet type thing. So that it was like, okay, I know why I'm here.
Yeah.
To be a minister. It was a calling. It was, there was nothing could stop me from it. And so I had a formal education in the school of ministry, and many other things happened that is like what I tell my students always is hold on to the tiger's tail. You know, when you're on the spiritual journey, because there are things that happened that I couldn't have believed. But all it did was continually get me deeper into awareness, meditation, affirmation, our prayer treatment. And I just loved it. It was like, what else would I do in life? You know, it was like, that's a calling. When you go, I'll do this for free, and I just about did as a minister.
I believe that.
Day and night, and but I just loved it, and I love it. I love to love to love.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it. And I like, it's not just knowing the intellectual awareness or readings and all, it's living it, and that's what matters. To live it.
That's exactly right, because he's the only minister that I met within the world of Science of Mind and Church of Religious Science, or was now called Centers for Spiritual Living. That's the current title for it. I met a lot of them. I was raised in many different cities throughout the nation. And by the time I was 14, I was in, I started my 12th school, and I was in Torrance, and there was a well-known Science of Mind church there. Unbeknownst to me, Richelieu. My uncle, Richelieu, his name was Richelieu, Cardinal Richelieu, I mean, the Reverend Richelieu, and his, my uncle and aunt were part of the founding members of that. So we're very much involved with Science of Mind.
Which is New Thought.
New Thought. I didn't know. I went there. I didn't understand it. I was very disturbed by all the family dynamics, all the suffering in my family, alcoholism and mental mental disease, and also our incapacity and violence. So, and then my father committed suicide in 1972. So it was all that I was trying to figure out. But I did go get involved with as many different spiritual traditions as I could. Mm-hmm. Although I was raised in a Catholic home, my grandmother and her brother were born in New Orleans, Louisiana. I didn't know that till I was 40, or till I was, I don't know, probably 60 years old, because they hid all of that. But
family secrets. Lots of them.
But it turned out that they were Catholic, and then my mother was Catholic. But then I went to Catholic church and realized that I just was stunned when the one time I went at about 11 years old to what was called catechism, I think, they said, here's what this means. And read a sentence and say, here's what this is supposed to mean. And we're all private and we're listening to the person who's supposed to know everything about everything. Here's what this means. And they always began the sentence with, you must fear and love God. And as soon as I heard those put together, I thought, this can't be so.
Yeah.
I didn't have the word bullshit at the time, but it was, I learned that later, but it was like fear and love God made no sense to me at all, none at all. And then I would go to the Sunday Mass whenever possible, and when I was there, it was all in Latin. And I was standing up and sitting down and didn't know why, and it was not being explained to anybody. It was all like a mystery that was impenetrable, and I just thought, there's got to be something better. So I just walked away at 11. I said, I'm not going to go back. I went to a Lutheran church, and they were much nicer about things, but also didn't explain anything. And so I said, well, okay, this is not so good. So I went to Baptist, and that didn't work out. So I went to Methodist, which was even nicer. It was nicer, actually. Enjoyed the Methodist. And then I began to look into every other kind of spiritual tradition that I could get a hold of, reading all the books about it. But it was book learning, and it wasn't deep into my own personal experience. But my father's suicide, I think, was probably a big turning point in my life.
Right.
At 27, you know, it was Saturn cycle.
You were 27, I was 28. Mm. Was the first husband as well, yeah. Very similar path.
I had already been, in and out of the U.S. Army, had already been scared shitless from having been involved in wartime, and so. But it was his suicide that I began to recognize more fully the impact of alcoholism and psychological struggles, depression, family dynamics, and so on. And I wanted to know, why was I so fucked up? What was going on? And I really worked hard about that, did every kind of thing that was at the time. Of course, it was during the in the 60s and 70s. I was involved with a lot of LSD and various forms of mescaline, various forms of psychedelics, trying to find out where was the center and what could be done that would be healthy and healing. But I didn't know what was health. I hadn't known anybody who was healthy in a way of giving and receiving and courage and being clean. I was very, very lucky then, a few years later, when I was involved in a bachelor's degree in psychology, I was lucky enough to be at a university that had a counseling center. And it just blew me away. The first time I sat down with a counselor at that university, I'd gone to some therapist once, a few years before that. But when I was at this university, I ran into a woman, Lynn Layton, wonderful, kind person, and she loved to counsel people. And I told her what was going on with me in the most transparent way I could, And because I felt profoundly terrible about my past. I felt guilty and ashamed. And I had a very specific memory of that, which was that when I was going to all these I went to inner city schools in downtown Los Angeles. I went to inner city schools on the south side of Chicago, and then Chicago generally. I was in pretty rough neighborhoods. And when I was in L.A., at a very young age, I think it was like 7 or something like that, I was going to the school, and the thing was, I was always a new kid, the new boy in the school, which was a challenge to the other people to be kind to me, but they weren't. So I remember that on my way home from that school, these two guys, this young boy and his cousin, jumped out of the bushes and just beat the crap out of me, held me down, and laughed as they said they were going to stick my thumb up my ass. And I was absolutely horrified and crying, and then didn't know what to do, feeling horrible. What am I going to do? I can't fight back. I don't want to fight. One of the things that was true of me always, I didn't want to do something to somebody that would hurt them, because I knew what it was like to be hurt. My brother would beat me up a lot. And I thought, I don't like that feeling. I don't want to do that to somebody else. So anyway, these two guys are beating me up. And then I was able to pull myself away, run across the street, run home, and told my older brother, who was usually the one who would beat me. But he was going, well, you got to do something about that. You know, you're a boy. You know, you're supposed to be a man. You're supposed to do something about it. And I went, no, I don't know. What am I going to do? And that summer, went to the big pool. It's a plunge, the local plunge. In the city, and I'm out there and talking to my brother, and I'll cross the other side of the pool where was the one guy who had beaten me up, and my brother said, go over there and kick him. And I thought, well, I'm supposed to do something like that, get back, do something. So I went over and I just put my foot near his leg like I was kicking him, right? And he looked at me, you know, and then his older brother said, you can't let him do that. So they then said, okay, let's meet outside of the swimming pool at the baseball diamond. There's a baseball diamond outside. There's a fence, you know, the back end fence where the baseballs would be stomped by the fence. And let's have a fight. So all of us went out to that. Turns out there were a lot of people who wanted to see these two little boys fight each other. I didn't want to fight. It seemed to me that it was kind of a game for a while, till finally I was out there and I'm standing in front of him, and he was a little bit shorter than I was, but he knew how to box. He had been taught by his older brother. I didn't know crap about it. And he came up to me and he bent his head down and he started hitting me as hard as he could in the stomach. Well, it didn't hurt, so I pushed him away, and he came back and he's hitting me as hard as he could, and it didn't hurt. And I pushed him away. So they came back again with his head down to hit me. And my brother said what our father who was a brown belt in jiu-jitsu, and my uncles were black belts going to Japan and all that stuff. So my brother says, remember what dad says, give him a judo chop to the neck, which would break his neck. And he's hitting me, and I push him, and then he says, give him a judo chop to the neck. And they're all like watching, right, and going, yay, hit him, do something. And so he's got his head down, and I pick my hand up and then I drop it and I just say, but I don't want to hurt him. And as soon as I said that, he stood up and hit me right in the mouth, broke my lip open, and I fell down and crying, and was carried to the water fountain. Blood was everywhere. And I went, oh my God, this is a horrible thing. What have I done? It's all my fault. Well, many years later, when I'm talking to Lynn Layton at the college counseling thing, I told this story, and I said how terrible I felt because I was a coward and ineffective and couldn't fight, and I wasn't a warrior, and I wasn't okay. And she looked at me, and she just looked at me so thoroughly, and she said, well, wow, even then, you were so compassionate, you didn't want to hurt anybody. And my whole life changed in one sentence. She reframed my fear, my sense of cowardice, my sense of that I'd done wrong, into compassion and kindness and understanding. my whole life changed in a matter of moments. It became unnecessary suffering. I never carried that experience again in the same way. I remember it quite well, but it got reframed. It got handled not by some technique that she had learned, but she actually believed in my kindness. She believed that I was sincere and concerned. I didn't want to hurt anybody. Well, I walked away from that going, this is amazing. I mean, I'd never been treated, I'd never been listened to before. Really listened to, professionally listened. And I determined I would find out everything I could about how to do that. So I went to lots of counselors and people that would now be called coaches at the university. I began to study and complete my studies in psychology. I then learned in my study in psychology that the study of psychology didn't teach me crap about how to help anybody. It's all about histories and systems and stuff like that. It was nice theoretical stuff like that. And I went into another business altogether. I was making leather goods, hats and belts and all kinds of stuff. But at the same time, I was fascinated with leading groups because I'd been leading groups and communication skills since before that. So I, in my 20s, so all of these groups were going on and I was helping to heal people. But I never believed enough in myself to complete that or to charge money for that or to do anything. So went on like that for quite a long time. Eventually, though, I went, you know what I really need is I need to complete this master's degree and find out what I can learn. It was in there that I began to learn during that university time how to listen. And I learned some baseline structures of how to listen, and then I developed and made it better. And then I became like a brilliant listener. I was able to listen to people at levels that they hadn't had before, and I began to teach people how to do that. So everything changed for me, but I still didn't know more than the heart. The heart, I talk about the heart and the sword. The heart is a metaphor for love and compassion and understanding, and it includes listening. But I didn't have the sword, which is a metaphor for, you know, procedures and step-by-step methodologies to produce change. So I had the heart, I didn't have the sword, and I determined that if there were any sword-like tools, I wanted to learn them. And then I was very lucky to find a great number of these tools in the field of neurolinguistic programming, which was useful for me to help resolve the unnecessary suffering of many, many different issues in people's lives. But it, NLP doesn't have anything to do with spirituality. In fact, Richard Banner, John Grinder, who created it, expressly are talking about how that has nothing to do with spirituality. It's all about reducing everything to essentially the brain and to the body. And they don't transcend that. They don't go through, you know, matter, life, mind, soul, divine. They know nothing about the great chain of being. They know nothing about going beyond this. In fact, they would reduce the spiritual to the mundane. And I, loving the tools that were able to help me help others, I went, okay, this is really great, but it has its limitations. And I didn't have a place where I could turn. There was no place for me to turn to get all of it. So instead of that, I invented it. And that's how I invented the destination method, which is an integration of the heart of compassion and the sword of technology and outcomes-empowered compassion. And that means that it's part of my vision for the world. I want to see the world populated with really powerful, compassionate healers. The compassion that Lynn Layton gave me when I was so young, and she just talked to me like a human being, and I felt the healing. And so I want people to have that kind of compassion in a skillful way. And I also wanted people to have more than she ever thought possible, because all she could do was that kind of a reframe, which was fabulous in and of itself. But it wouldn't solve a trauma, and it wouldn't solve grief, and it wouldn't solve any number of things in some predictable way. Well, I began to not only discover, but create many, many, many tools that, in fact, resolve unnecessary suffering. And then I was lucky enough to recognize that I didn't know crap how to have a healthy, wonderful, loving relationship. So I was really an expert at screwing up my relationships, not having sufficient truth and vulnerability to be in a relationship that was loving and being loved. I saw Luzette. I ran into her. I was singing at a church up in Fremont.
And who happened to be my sister and brother-in-law's church.
Yeah.
So I came in from L.A. going up to Seattle, mm-hmm. and he was singing in 1982.
And you saw her.
I saw her. Immediately I went, there she is.
Two and a half years after
it was
Carl had committed suicide.
Very shortly after
her. Very, it was an incredible singer.
And I didn't know that she was a widow.
But you recognized her immediately is what I'm...
I went, there's a light I couldn't forget. Mm. And I went, oh my God. So I wanted to go out with her right away. I wanted to do something, have a date. But I was involved with somebody else. And I went, well, I guess it's just not going to happen. So that was, and
was
she's on her way,
through,
she was just going to
Seattle.
I had
a boyfriend in LA.
So I just kept singing at that church and developing my tools and skills. And
he sang there almost every Sunday.
And then
probably trying to hang out with you.
I wouldn't. Exactly. This is
you didn't know that.
Northern California, I'm in LA.
But a year later, she came back. I walk in and there she is. Yeah. I'm going, okay. And then I went over and I said, let's go somewhere. I was stunned that she said yes. I was stunned. I was going, oh my God, how is this possible?
I asked my sister if, you know, he was okay. He's wonderful. Yes, go out with him.
So we went out. We went to a wonderful dinner and all that. And
everything was so afraid.
Everything was
because he was so
beautiful.
Smart. I thought he would know that I was broken.
But I noticed she was not telling me the truth much. And then when we were sitting in the car at Dunkin' Donuts, which is where the fabulous place I took her to.
After singing, he sang at this... piano bar, even. I mean, it's like everything I could
really
have ever thought of. I was scared to death.
Yeah.
Well, when we kissed, it went bonk.
And the kiss was nothing.
It was terrible.
It was awful.
It was just like,
oh my God.
Oh well, he's not the one, and he's thinking she's not the one.
Not going to happen here.
God.
And I went, okay, this is so disappointing. I thought this was going to be fabulous. Okay, so let it go. So then, then that was the end of that. She went away. And a couple of years later, I thought about her again, and I couldn't find her telephone number, so I called her sister, and I said, what's Lizette's phone number? And she says, I don't know. I don't know anything about her. And I was going,
I don't know her phone number.
She was not open to me at all.
At all.
So I gave up. I went, well, I guess it's not to be. You know, cards, it's not open. Door's not open. Let it go. And then it took many years till I saw her again. But when I saw her again, she was married. And so I was going... Wow. And then later on after that, 6 years after that, in 1998, I walked into her church. And I've been looking into spiritual things for so long, and I knew so much about how to resolve suffering, and I knew some sources of that. And I also knew something about what she was a master of.
Because you were at my brother-in-law and sister's church for
years. And I walked
eight
in
years.
There.
8 years. She heard the sermon.
There she is giving her service. And two things came. First thing that came to me was, you know what? We're gonna go get together. It's going to be perfect. It'll be the best thing that ever happened. And she's going to think it's from her spiritual mind treatment from Science of Mind. She's going to think it's some spiritual thing. But I'm going to know,
he didn't know
that
I
it's
really
not
was,
that.
He didn't know I was
But we're going to have the most wonderful relationship in history. And she's going to claim that. And I walk in and I see her there. And I go, and then I look. And the next thing I see is that she's wearing some beautiful clothes, but there was some frayedness on this shirt. And I went, and no magnificent jewelry. And I went, nobody's taking care of her. What is this? This is nuts. She deserves everything. Just like that. I want to take care of her. I want to provide for her and protect her, and I want to love her, and I want her to love me. So when I'm leaving, she's standing at the door, and I said, hi, I'm Robert McDonald. She suddenly remembers me. She had forgotten me.
Because I met him like four times.
That's
over
right.
17
and
years.
He was a bad
and
kisser.
I never remembered him.
It was so annoying. It rained so much.
No, because my motto was, next, if I didn't like someone, next, I'd forget it. Forget him, right?
Smart.
And so I'd always forget him, and then I remember.
She did, and then I go, hey, listen, you know, I've been all over the world, teaching all over the world, and I don't like it anymore, and I want to do something with the love of my life. And she said to me, so do I.
It's
and
like
I went,
a match.
Oh. And we have been together literally ever since.
Ever since that moment.
Yeah.
Ever since.
Wow.
And so it just got better. So
I got better. All of my dreams come true because I learned everything he knows and more. I mean,
well, you got the sword and he got the heart. Yeah. I mean, you had a beautiful heart and you're a very smart woman. But
I didn't know.
You guys gave each other extraordinary gifts.
When I took Healing the Wounded Heart, I thought this is exactly what I need because my heart has been broken. Being a minister, it's like, wow, I'm giving all this love and people would leave and they're not getting it. Where are they going? What's happening? You know, it's like,
yeah.
And then to learn the sword and learn everything. I mean, tools that I could really be effective with helping people.
Yeah, and pull all the stingers out of your own heart.
Oh, and myself.
Salve on the bruises.
I checked everything out. Everything.
Yeah.
And it's still...
So there was a first husband and there was a second husband. Mm-hmm. So the third time you met Robert, you weren't in the second marriage anymore?
No.
That's
divorced
correct.
In 1995. I was married 1990-1995 and he came in 1998. And when I was going to go, I knew I was to divorce him because he said he wanted to be spiritual, but he really couldn't.
The second husband.
The second husband. And I remember something came up and I just knew. I got mad. I never had gotten mad. I said, I want a divorce. He went out and got the papers. And I thought, okay, there's the sign.
Yeah.
And that was it. I closed the door.
Nice.
And then I went on a walk to the ocean, and I heard, your soulmate's coming. Or he's coming, it's it. You know. And so I knew. So I gave me that strength to carry through, not to stick and be hanging out with someone I really knew wasn't the one. Right?
Yeah.
So I let go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It took him 3 years.
What a dawdler.
Yeah. It was weird because I went up. I went up to the area where her church was only because I received two reasons. I received something in the mail that never came. A newsletter from her church, and it was like, how did they find my address?
Never.
And there's a photograph of her, and I went. Oh, yes. What am I doing? I got to go see her.
There's Lizette.
It looks to me that she's using her maiden name. I bet she's divorced now. Oh, I got it. That's what I'm going to do. And then my friend up there was dying of cancer, and I went, I'm going to go there, and I'm going to help him to die. We did a very deep process. Heart
of
the heart.
You all know Heart of the Heart?
Yeah.
That's a wonderful
he
one for transition.
He took his friend through that so he could clean and clear everything and make his transition.
And he, in fact, did that.
And he did.
And then I went into the church and saw Lizette. And that's why she saw some gray around me. And then we talked.
Because he was feeling sad.
Yeah. We talked deep forever after that.
It was really... very interesting.
And
right?
You talked deeply forever.
Yeah. And I began to learn how to love. You know, that was what it was. I began to learn how to love. And
I said to him, or I knew, I said, I want somebody deep. Are you deep? Are you kidding?
Oh.
I think I got the deepest person. I didn't know what the word meant. But I knew the other one was surface and every all these people.
Well, so years ago when you first went on a date with him, you had your mask
that's right.
up. And
so how could I really kiss him, right?
Yeah, exactly. And what did it take in the years intervening for you to learn to let that down?
Well, so that was 1982, so it was like almost 3 years. It took me 3 more years to really feel like I was myself again. Mm. And mainly how I did my healing was spiritually.
Yep.
So that's why I dove in. And when I wanted, then I really, I became a practitioner, which was the healing arm of the center. And then I really wanted to be a minister. I wanted to learn more and go deeper and help others. And my thought was I want to help people stop them from suicide.
Mm.
That was my thought.
Mm.
You know, this, it was just too much. There was so much I missed. Well, so I went in, you know, into the ministry and studied for a couple years. Now, see, still he wasn't back, right? So now I'm learning,
mm-hmm.
and as a practitioner, I gave classes, I'd make up courses and all. I was always teaching workshops and all, and find teaching from what I'd read or what I'd experienced, and on and on. So how I let go of all that was, I became myself. I got into my own power as a minister, and I was totally self-reliant. I'd have boyfriends and all, but for 3 months I could have a romance and I go next. I mean, it's like still my heart was locked. So
I mean, the boys were lining up for you, Lizette. I'm sure.
I had no problem. But I couldn't really love for a long time. Yeah. And so I did everything I could because I wanted to really be able to love and have romance and be married again. Because I love to be married. I love to love to love, right? Yeah, so I did everything spiritually and did some workshops and stuff around L.A., but and then helped and taught, and so I opened more and more. And then when Robert came back into my life, when I was really excited, he said to me something that really changed my life. He said, I said to him, I realized in relationships, there's no guarantee. Mm. I said, oh, I got married again 5 years, and I had to go through this divorce. See, the first, I didn't even have to divorce. I didn't ever want a divorce, right?
No.
And I just had to, and I realized there's no guarantees in relationship. And what did you say to me?
I said, of course there's a guarantee. You're completely wrong about that. There's an absolute guarantee that if we do this, if we love fully, completely, and open-heartedly, our hearts will be broken. And a broken heart is guaranteed.
I thought, oh my God, I just thought I'd healed my broken heart, and I've got to make a decision to love again, knowing that my heart will be broken again. And
no
I said,
what?
How can you say that? It was like my head spun. I said, what do you mean?
Because everything that's born dies.
So it was either we would break up or one of us would die.
It's guaranteed.
That so, is a deep Scorpio line.
No, if someone said that to me, I'd be like, wow.
So
that would have gotten me too.
What I didn't know, I'm a triple Leo, right? So, but I didn't know that my Mars is in Scorpio.
Oh,
so
this
was
that.
You too. Yeah. This was the deep meeting deep, right?
Yeah.
Because my Leo's out there
and
shining
my Mars
bright.
Is in Leo.
And aww. His Mars. See, this is where we go. It's
Pluto's
really,
in Leo, of course, but my Mars is in Leo.
I mean, our charts are like one on top of the other.
Right.
Mm. It's just amazing.
Perfectly.
Do you have Mars? Is your Mars conjunct or I guess co-joined Pluto? Is it? Close to
well, I can't remember now where the
okay.
what house it's in.
Sorry,
I
interrupted.
I really don't. I don't know the answer to that question. I know Mars is in Leo and Pluto is in Leo. Yeah, Pluto's a generational sign.
Yeah.
But Mars, I don't know where they are.
I was just curious because I have Mars and Pluto conjunct in
you
Scorpio.
Do. In Scorpio.
It's the serial killer aspect.
We have Mars in Scorpio is very very powerful, and I kept knowing that about Lizette.
He knew more than I did about astrology. He immediately looked at it and go, well, oh, she's a good one.
The power of all that.
But that's where, you know, it's
the
like.
The relentlessness in him meets the relentlessness in you.
Yeah, and that's why, like, spiritually I gathered all information, and it's like, then it was time, okay, let's really get down into. Yeah. Some people, this one woman I've worked with, and she just loves everything that ever happened. One destination at a time is what we do with Destination Method.
Yeah.
One. And she was somebody that was out there in the world helping really big name people succeed. And then she crashed from things that happened, betrayal and stuff. And so then through me, she was able to go deep and heal stuff. She
all
did.
Of it.
She didn't think she had to because she wanted to just stay in joy all the time.
Right.
On a spiritual level. And it's like, well, we are psychological beings, right? So she calls me like, I'm the Roto-Rooter for the soul.
Oh, nice.
What
nice.
An idea.
I love that.
But, and this is what, you know, I loved. I have learned and...
Well,
and then we teach everything we know.
I just love learning so much about you guys, and I love how much you share about yourselves. And I just want to say that, you know, I can remember a past Layla who would have met these, like, lovely, joyful beings and been like, they're full of shit. Mm-hmm. They are just faking it. What are they doing? And I want to say that one of the things that really made me believe in Dr. Robert was when you shared just a little snippet of talking about yourself, like, vomiting on the floor out of like the intensity of your emotional experience.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay, I can trust what this man has to say because he has been there. He has mm-hmm. been to the bottom.
Yeah.
And now he's right here.
Yeah.
Everybody's been
Isn't
there.
Great?
They either talk about it or they don't.
Right.
But I was there many times.
So we like to be transparent. We'll tell you anything.
Yeah.
Because that's what makes us real, you know?
Yeah. I was wondering, I think it would be useful to hear the two of you talk a bit about your experiences with recovering from having a loved one commit suicide, because I know that all grief is really difficult for people, but it seems like it's a really special
oh, yeah.
kind of difficulty with
It's the hardest.
Suicide.
So I did the spiritual path and then did some, this is what was interesting. I went deep into spirituality. I didn't even have counseling. I was 28 years old with two girls. A year later, I moved to California thinking I was destined to be a movie star. I thought, oh, that's what, at least that's, he gave me a bright vision to be able to think of something. But I had, the greatest thing, I got away from the family. Because they just, you know, it was just too much, and I couldn't face him. So I got to go deep spiritually to do healing. Mm-hmm. And then meeting Robert, he goes, remember I said that I thought that it was, my mission was to help people prevent suicide? Mm. Because you can't do that. I go, oh, no. You mean like everything I thought?
This guy just keeps dropping bombs on you.
He goes, you can't. If they're going to commit suicide, they're going to. I go, come on. And it's like hard for me to believe that, right?
Well, but it's because my father committed suicide. Because
he knew this.
So what, and many I other relatives.
Got deeper into resolving the grief, in which I had. Mm. You know, and then we checked out with his methods and all where I was, and it was like I had found my way.
Absolutely.
Well, I guess what I was curious about is with the grief from the suicide, was there like a feeling of guilt connected to it?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Always. Always.
Guilt, shame. Oh, my God. Of course it was my fault.
Suicide's very
special.
And then
especially, can you imagine? I go into the funeral parlor where he's laid out, and his mother said, there she is. She did it.
Oh, my God.
That's
and I've got my daughters there in the family. I'm going, what's going on? She blamed me totally.
Wow.
So, I mean, I had to go through a lot. I mean, it surface, you would have known because I'm a Leo.
Put it on the show.
Right?
A shiny
show. I was
show.
A model, the top model in St. Louis. Yeah. I went I back to work 100%. 1 week later. I walk in with a black hat and a veil on, and someone said, I'm so sorry for what happened. I said, the show must go on.
Spoken like a true Leo.
Can you believe
my God.
It? I didn't know I was that good.
Anyway. Leo,
triple
right?
Leo.
Triple Leo.
You couldn't even help yourself.
So
of
my
you
sorrow
had to say
and sadness was in private where no one knew.
Yeah, well, where we're taught to like keep it.
Jesus,
is to like not let anybody know that that's happening.
Yeah, which is a great.
I didn't want to upset anyone. I'm okay.
Yeah.
Mm. Can you believe a year later I go to California with my daughters?
Hey,
totally
was that,
in distress.
Sometimes you just gotta go. Sometimes you just gotta go.
True.
Take it from me. I know
that's
for
a brave Leo act, right?
It is.
Anyway.
Well, that was very impressive.
So it was quite a journey.
Healing. She had healed herself.
Deep.
She had done it through spiritual means, and she became obvious to me that she was doing and living science of mind principles, where I had met many, many ministers, and she was the one who actually was living it,
so
literally deep in her heart.
And on my own, I was able to resolve the grief from my spiritual means and everything. Mm. And so to meet him and know that there's actually a way, there is a ceremony to resolve grief, to honor your loved ones. You know, and I've done that with everyone. I was surprised. Like, I've taken so many workshops, I'd be helping people or doing it, and I was surprised some of the family members that I resolved grief with. But so that's what's beautiful.
And that is so stunning. It was because, it's stunning enough that you know how to resolve painful memories, traumatic memories, because that's huge.
Sure.
And like grief, I had never heard before I met you two that any resolution of grief was possible.
That's
that
right.
Had never entered my consciousness. Nobody had ever said that
also that's
the
not,
world is taught it's not resolvable.
That's due to the consciousness level, that because people who are trained grief counselors are trained to say to people who are, for example, parents who've lost a child, they're also trained to say, well, you'll never get over this. It's unnatural for the younger person to die. You'll never get over this. It'll be like this the rest of your life. All you can do is get used to it. They're trained to say that. And that's only because, not because they're mean. They're not mean. They're not cruel. They're just unaware. They don't know what is the source of grief. They don't know how grief exists, and they don't know how to solve grief. That's the normal, because the understanding of the mind is not taught at universities, and it's not taught certainly in grief counseling circles. So what I did when I was getting my master's degree, I got it in counseling and mental health with an emphasis in marriage and family counseling. And I wrote my master's thesis on survivors of suicide, since I'm a survivor of suicide. My father committed suicide, and also many family members committed suicide, including my father's grandson. So suicide after suicide. And what I was interested in is reading and understanding suicide and grief as well as anybody in the world. So I did it. I learned all of that kind of stuff. And nobody knew how to resolve grief. Nobody. People could define it. Some people thought the best way to define grief was to count how many tears came out of the person and how long they cried. It was all measurement. But nobody knew how to actually address grief. Grief is a result of thinking about someone that you love very much and thinking of them as lost, gone, and in the past. So as long as...
Even thinking of them up in heaven somewhere in the universe, that's grief.
Lost, it's like they're gone, lost, and they're in gone. The past. So as long right. As long as the representative is lost, gone, and in the past, grief will occur. So the solution to grief is the same worldwide. Anybody who gets over grief in the same way. Grieving is the same, and the resolution of grief is the same worldwide. But when people talk about it, they'll say things in order to kind of be politically correct. They'll say, well, everybody grieves in their own way, you know. That's kind of individual, idiosyncratic. But in truth, at the deepest level, people grieve the same way. They feel it in the same location of their body, which is in the chest and the lungs, and they feel a sense of concavity in the chest. And they do that whenever they think of the loved one who's dead. Or it doesn't have to be a person. It could be a person, a place, a thing, an activity, an information. Something's lost, gone, and in the past. When the person who's grieving begins to think of the person as present, they begin to notice a change in their bodily experience, and when they're fully convinced of the presence of the person, they're no longer grieving. This is a simple change of mind that can be done very quickly. A woman I worked with who lost her 22-year-old son in December, I met her in February, we sat down, and in one session she resolved shock, trauma, and grief. That was many years ago.
In 2 hours.
And you can call her up and talk to her.
It's on our website.
It's on our website.
So you can
Jean Swan.
Hear her.
And it comes not, I'm not special. This is a matter of understanding how the mind works. So after my studies in grief, I then realized I didn't know how to solve grief. So I began to explore what was going on at the time. And the geniuses of Stephen Connery Andreas out in Colorado was they had unpacked grief. I didn't believe it. I went to Colorado to prove them wrong because I had a master's degree and I knew, and then I found out how wrong I was. I went, I'm completely and utterly wrong. I learned how to resolve grief. I did videotapes of me resolving grief. I gave it away. I gave away a grief counseling, grief coaching, grief resolution for a very long time, just for free, because I wanted to be the world's best. I wanted to know how it works so that I'm never lost in the situation and the misunderstandings that people have. Essentially, this is understandable by something that happened in Virginia a long time ago. I don't know if you remember the Sago mine disaster. Do you remember this thing? The Sago mine disaster happened in Virginia. A coal mine collapsed. And so all the relatives were informed that not everybody came out of the coal mine. And there were like 13 males who would go down there. We hadn't come out, so all the relatives and the friends came to the headquarters, and they sat around and they talked to each other, like waiting for the news that they were okay. And while they were sitting there, the CEO of the whole thing was in contact with people who were searching for the people who were under the ground. And everybody was being told, "We don't know. You know, they might be alive, they might be dead. Well, they're on pins and needles. Of course, they're loved ones." So then a phone call comes up from the depths and talked to the CEO and said, "Oh, they're alive." Well, he went, they had some small evidence of that. So he took the small evidence, exaggerated it into they're absolutely alive, and told the people who were sitting around, all these people, well, they jumped up and down, they hugged each other, they high-fived, drank champagne. Oh my God, isn't it great? They're coming up, right? So now they're really happy. They went from anxiety to real happiness.
Just like that.
Within 30 minutes, he got another call. And in 30 minutes, they said, they're all dead. And he came and he went to himself. He thought to himself, I can't tell them this. They're happy. I can't tell them the truth. what am I going to do? He deliberated on this for 3 hours. So for 3 hours, they're going, fabulous, wonderful, we're going to see our loved ones in just a matter of time. Then he walks in and he says, I got to tell you the truth. I didn't tell you the truth before. They're dead. They went immediately from happiness to total grief and anger and frustration. They were pissed off at him and everybody else. Well, I want you to know that at no time were they not dead. They were dead. How is it possible that they felt so good when they were told that they were alive? And how is it possible that they felt so bad when they were told they were dead? They had no direct evidence of this at all. They changed their minds. When they thought of them as alive, they rejoiced because they go, okay, they're not here. There's a lot of people not here. So what? They're not here. They're present. Just like right now, you can think of somebody you love who's not in this room, they're somewhere else. You don't grieve them because your understanding is that they're alive. So they may very well have died 20 minutes ago, but you cannot think about that without going into grief. So what happened is after they said that they were grieving and they were dead and they were grieving, of course, everybody was shocked and angry with him and so on. And then they came away feeling that and noticing that. And of course, they had to bury their dead. Well, what happens then when somebody changes from grief to gratitude? What is that shift? And that shift is not that the facts change, it's that the mind changes. So when my father committed suicide and I grieved, he blew himself away on Christmas Day. So every Christmas it was grief time, autumn, you know, annual grief, right? Yearly grief. Go, okay, what is it that needs to be done? I had to think of him as present. Present. He's here. I have my father here. I have my mother right near him. I don't grieve them because they're present in my life. So I see them three-dimensional in color right here. And this is exactly what people do without being taught when they successfully resolve a grief.
It can be done.
And is done. It's done by people who stumble across
it. They can stumble, but we are going to teach you all this the next time we're together in Healing Wounded Heart Part 2.
Yeah, we're going to learn how to change the mind.
Yeah, you're always changing the mind because you're like a map maker. And all of your experiences are made from how you've thought about it. Through what you've seen, what you see, what you hear, what you feel, what you taste and smell. Those are your thoughts. That's how you make mental maps, and we can change your thinking and change your
very
life.
Very directly, yeah.
We want to tell you, because I think we're wrapping
we're
up.
We're coming to the end of our time.
We're at the end. We have self-love skills class coming up, and that's going to be July 14th, 15th, 16th. And they're phenomenal. It's about assertion, empathy, and forgiveness. So we teach skills so people know how to talk and have an actual experience of change.
To foster love.
That's right. It's all about love. That's what this is, this thing called life. It's all about love.
And the little, looks like we have maybe 2 minutes left. Would you tell us about the listening?
And the dynamic listening, which is phenomenal. Carolyn can tell you more about it later because she took it and changed her life.
But this is a professional coach.
Yeah. It's November 7th to the 12th. And it's for professional, but for everyone. We've had married people take this and go, they never knew how to talk to their spouse.
Listen, they never knew how to listen.
Never knew, because they couldn't listen.
Right.
So it's phenomenal. It'll be on our website. And Carolyn will tell you, it's November 7th through 12th here at the Hilton Garden Inn in El Segundo for 6 days. And then self-love skills, which goes with that. So you can be assertive and listen. So you're not just a doormat. But this dynamic listening is for all people, counselors, therapists, coaches, salespeople, physicians.
And there's transformation from the storytelling.
Yeah, the listening can be transformation. And then also we teach you how to tell metaphorical healing stories, not only how to do it, but you get them. What did you get, like 200 stories and embedded commands of your health, whatever you want.
It's great for adults and children.
And core transformation in different storytelling. So it's pretty hot.
These are coming up.
It's amazing. Oh, I highly recommend taking anything from Robert and Lizette.
Take everything Robert and Lizette do. And we will we'll send out more information about these courses via email. So if you're not on my email list, go to carolyngraceelliott.com and enter your emails. You can receive updates. And thank you so much for listening, everybody. Please, you know, like, leave a review, tell your friends, and check out TelosCenter.com.
Telos Healing Center.
TelosHealingCenter.com.
Yeah, and they'll read a bunch of stuff, but it's an old clunky website.
Yeah.
Well truly, love is the law. Love under will.
Yeah. Talk to you next time, guys. Bye. Bye-bye.